Okay, let me also start by thanking the three guys who set this whole thing up. And it is my singular privilege to have been associated with this man for the last 28 years. And just to make sure everyone in this room knows, I am the luckiest person in this room, probably the planet, and I know that. Okay? In thinking about what I wanted to do with this, it actually came very late, about a week ago, 2 weeks. And I thought about metamorphosis, and one of the things that's really important about metamorphosis is habitat or environment. And that's going to be a key word in not only describing what I want to talk about in terms of what I've done, but what Wendell has done for us. And I think it encapsulates the key, one of the key concepts of why there's been so much success in this program. So habitat begins with the top figure there. That's the Ag Experiment Station in Geneva, which by itself is an incredible place to work. Okay, and we're going to zoom down, and the bottom picture is Barton Lab. Houses the entomology and plant pathology departments and Wendell's empire since the mid-60s. His office and main labs are on the sixth floor, but we have the plant pathologists are in 2 and 1, but we've had our fingers in most of the rest of that place for a long time. Now I want to zoom down even further, because the really magic place for me in terms of environment is in the basement. And environment, again, encapsulates not just this physical part, but what Wendell gives us in terms of a place and sort of a great place to play and work and do things. And that's the flight tunnel. So this is the tunnel that Jim Miller built in the mid-70s, and this is where I've lived for 28 years. And I can remember someone, I won't name the name of one of the persons in Wendell's group, shortly after I got there, who said, is that all you're ever going to do is do stuff in the tunnel? And the answer is yes. Actually, this is the first test that was ever done in the tunnel. That's Jim Miller. And I can tell you, I've done a lot of things in the tunnel and spent a lot of time. I've never seen anything like that at the source. come on. Okay, so here's my sort of rogues gallery, a partial grouping of the insects that I've been able to actually work with or help others work with and actually watch. And I don't have, obviously, time to go over all of these stories. And I don't show this to, you know, pump my feathers up. This is, again, sort of a display of the environment that Wendell has allowed over this period of time to explore and probe, and again, as you've heard today, Wendell's not a tyrant. He directs things. He tends to drop these little hints. Sometimes, as Baker said, you scratch your head and roll your eyes, and damn it, he turns out to be right. But I'm going to talk about a theme that involves moths and the flight tunnel and try to take you through some of this. So I apologize for colleagues who are related to some of these other insects that I'm not going to talk about. Okay, and the value of the tunnel, as Jim told me just a couple of days ago when he built the thing, it's because, and as Tom just showed, it gives you just so much more of a rich appreciation and information about what these insects are doing. It's an incredibly sensitive tool for elucidating moth preferences for odor quality, and that's really my thing. And yet it's a very simple device. It's for those of us like myself who are mechanically challenged, this is my kind of place. Duct tape, wood, and an easy thing to change or move around. The tunnel doesn't look exactly like this now. It's square with sliding doors, but the frame and the rest of it are the same. It's a simple box fan, a plastic bag, some sheets of cheesecloth that are changed twice a year. Other than that, the thing runs every day, except for 1 week during the Christmas break when Cornell wants to save some energy. So it works. Okay, I actually began my trek in this business with Harry Shorey. There I am over all the way on the left, the beginning of my Charlie Manson days, look-alike. Lou Biostad standing next to me, and of course Harry over to the right of the slide. I owe Lou an awful lot. You'll see that as my story goes along. And I came to Harry's group in the late 70s to work in the flight tunnel. He had a flight tunnel, and he was engaged in a very vigorous debate, discussion with John Kennedy, one of the godfathers of this whole business, in England over orientation mechanisms, how do moths get upwind. And Harry was a proponent with his student Stan Farkas of chemotaxis as opposed to anemotaxis, which was the England version and turns out to be correct. And you'll hear, I'm sure you're going to hear more about that when Ring comes up. Tom sort of hinted at that. I wasn't really interested in any of that at all. And at the time, Lou Biostad was working with Cabbage Looper on the identification of a secondary component. And this got me very interested in this whole question about blends, because it was becoming clear at that time, as you've already seen, the 70s were just an enormously exciting time in this business, and Wendell's group, and Harry's as well. Harry was running huge disruption tests down in the desert in the cotton fields. I spent my first summer putting pheromone hoops on cotton plants for pink bollworm. We had a huge group. It was very unfortunate that he one day came in, said he was leaving the business, put his pencil down, and was gone in one afternoon, which left me to finish my dissertation in a year. But I had this nice thing going, and I had my tunnel, and it was very much, at least I tried to model it on the one that Jim had built. And again, going along with the ethology kind of description and modeling at that time, where people were finding out that pheromone components were active at particular stages of behavioral sequences, I showed in the wind tunnel that dodecyl acetate aided the landing response of Cabbage Looper males. And so that was a very, very interesting time. My most interesting event in the flight tunnel in Riverside was the day an earthquake shook the building. That was kind of neat. Okay, then I came to Wendell's group in 1980. And the reason I came there was Tom Baker regrettably had to leave. He was having a really great time, as you just saw, generating all these mountains with oriental fruit moth. And he went and took the position that Harry had left and convinced me that I should try make contact with Wendell, and Lou Biostad was doing the same thing. And so I came there in April of that year, sort of musical chairs. So I have, in addition to 1 million other things, I can thank Tom for that. And at that time, again, I was introduced to this wonderful insect, the oriental fruit moth. It's just a beautiful animal in the flight tunnel, and it flies in the light, and you can just do lots and lots of things with it, as you'd already seen. And of course, the thing at that time was Wendell's threshold hypothesis. This is paper 128 in his list of 382 right now. And not only do I think it's one of the most important, even though I agree with Tom that it was kind of a scratch your head thing at the time, it's one of his only single authored papers. And maybe that's because he's the only one who believed in it at the time. I don't know. Anyway, he had these two thresholds that he described for encompassing an attraction area for different moths. And equally important, this whole thing came out of a problem in the field. Wendell's always been very interested in making this whole business applied and using this stuff. So this came out of a question from field trapping data that had been gathered for some moths. So as Tom showed you, one of the ways that we started with this was to take these matrices of doses and concentrations and test 1,000 many, many moths. And so I came and continued what Tom had been doing. And so this is what happens, this is what you get when you test 10,000 individual oriental fruit moths. And so the matrix is basically one of cis-trans mixtures and doses, and then each line represents a different amount of the third component added to the blend. And we created these mountains in an effort to see if we could look at these threshold effects. And Tom did a very nice job in helping me in not have to spend a lot of time on this, because as you can see, you can do that. Now, there were several things that came out of this just looking at this figure. but also in terms of the analysis, and that is looking at the top line, you need all the components. And so what I want to do here is kind of give you an idea of when I looked at this figure for hours on end, I began to realize that what I wanted to do was, what I needed to do was not just analyze things by behavior, but figure out a way to quantify or give a measure to a particular treatment in terms of the entire response pattern. Okay? And so some of the things that we learned from this is this complete blend, which will becomes increasingly important. There's an incredible sensitivity in this insect to the cis-trans mixture. Okay, these are very, very small amounts of material, and they're telling great, great differences between 6 and 10%. There was less sensitivity to the other alcohol, so there's some flexibility in the system with respect to that. You can go a huge range and still get a lot of moths coming all the way to the source. And finally, the entire response pattern was affected by odor quality. And this was a very different kind of way than I had been thinking of in terms of my previous experience with cabbage zupers. So I'm going through my metamorphosis here. Okay, so this is a blow up of one of those panels, shortened down, showing the three key behaviors with 3% alcohol. And you can see, as you go from the left to right, taking flight, where there's not very much discrimination at all. But once you ask the insects, are they interested in flying upwind of this, you see very dramatic effects with higher ratios and especially higher doses. And as Tom showed, this is a cartoon of a method that I use. What I did was I used a cluster analysis to take a measure for each of the response profiles for the 100 treatments and see if they would group together in ways that gave some feeling about what was going on. And so the area there in the blue is an area of treatments that would give equally high responses. And then as you go away from there, dramatic effects occurred on behavior. And certainly the one that was most of interest at that time was this arrestment effect, insects stopping their upwind flight in their process and giving rise to this threshold effect. Now, my first experiment when I came to Wendell's lab was along that line, and what we wanted to do was see if this proportion or the importance of the E isomer on this effect. And what I did was pre-expose males to that single component alone, and we learned that we could actually blow this mountain up and expand it out. And many other studies that I'm not going to talk about, in which we varied temperature and a variety of other things, and also a lot of experimentation that I did with biogenic amines, showing how flexible these thresholds were and how you could move this thing around. Again, Wendell allowed all of that because of this environment that he had created. And I think somebody this morning said, you can't get out of Wendell's lab without working on Red Bandit in some way. You also can't get out of there without doing chemistry. And so for me, that was HPLC with electrochemical detection. But that's a whole nother story. So this whole concept of blends was changing in my mind, and this was just a really wonderful time. And it was so much fun making these mounts, we did it again with the pink bollworm. And here was another insect that had some interesting trapping data about changes in preference of blends that due possibly to a change in temperature effects on dosage and the ability of males to respond at some dosages to blends that they might not otherwise. And you can see on the right, we're now making this a little fancier with these contour maps. And again, several points were verified. Wendell had predicted that the greatest sensitivity or the maximal response at the lowest dose would be to the natural blend. And in every case we've done this kind of thing, that's been true. But as you go up in doses, you can go out and see that there are other blends that are pretty good. So there were some things coming that were being verified about the hypothesis itself. The other thing that's encapsulated in the threshold hypothesis that wasn't stated at the time, but becomes obvious as you look at these figures, is there's variability in the male response. We call that response specificity or the breadth of response, and that turns out to become even more important as we go on. Okay, coffee break, yes. This is environment part two. If you're in the building at 10 o'clock in the morning, you get your butt downstairs and you're at this event. and that's been law for a long time, and it's just an wonderful, wonderful time where lots of things happen. And it includes the whole group, very importantly. It's not a thing where the senior scientists sit around and garble. It's everybody is there. This is actually a staged photograph for one of Wendell's talks on the coffee break and its importance in the cabbage soup identification, I think it was. Wendell and I, Lou and I, look much cleaner here than we actually were at the time. You'll see in a moment. So here's the important part. We talk about a lot of things at coffee break, but when there was science going on, and it was really good, and Lou was coming down, he was doing all this biosynthesis stuff, which you heard about all morning, so I don't even have to go into that either. But he would come down, and he would make these chicken scratchings on the board, and he and Wendell would go back and forth, and they would talk about things, and da-da-da-da-da, and I'm sitting there watching this whole thing happen, and of course, it led to this, and you've seen this figure before, but I want to add a little bit of my perspective, because what was really incredibly interesting to me was that Lou and Wendell came to this diagram and predicted that these would be the six components that were involved in the cabbage looper pheromone. It wasn't a matter of continuing to try to find compounds in the gland. He was saying, based on first principles, or principles of the biosynthesis pathway, this is what the pheromone is. And that turned a click in my head in terms of the behavioral approach I was now going to take and doing some flight tunnel tests. And I have to tell you, I didn't want to do that because I had developed an enormous allergy to the scales of the wings of this insect when I was in Riverside. And I'm sitting there at coffee break realizing, oh God, I know where this is going. But it was okay because it turned out to be really great. Okay, and so these are the components, and yes, we did show in the flight tunnel in a really wonderful period of time working with Lou and Dr. Du that these six components, in fact, are very active, and I was really stunned in the first few days when I began to test this blend against the previous experience I had had with the two-component blend, and it was just night and day. This was a really pretty marvelous thing. So it changed my thinking, too, as I said. Because in years past, when a new compound was thought to be a pheromone component, what people did was addition assays. And you show that some behavior is increased. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. This is the pheromone. Okay? And we got this really high response to it. So I'm going to take things out. So I reversed our thinking and our strategy, and we did these subtraction assays. And I'm not going to go through all of that, but I'm going to point out three important things. Again, these males are just incredibly sensitive to the entire mixture, and they are throughout the entire response sequence. That was very clear. There was redundancy in the signal. There are four component blends that are as good as the six, but individual minor components could be substituted in unique pairs to produce those four component blends, so it still convinced me that the entire mixture was part of the pheromone. And finally, we also showed in some other studies, not necessarily at this time, that these pheromone components can also function as behavioral antagonists. So while their presence in the blend might not appear to have a great impact on attraction to those females, they may also be there doing other things. And this was the really great study we did was with Abner Hammond, and after identifying the soybean looper and showing that Z512 acetate here in the cabbage looper blend, which is not released by soybean females, but soybean males are very, very sensitive to this compound, shuts them down, rests their flight. They have a unique neural pathway for this, and it's added to a growing, what is now a really solid database on the role of behavioral antagonists. The other interesting thing about this study, show you how crazy this whole group continues to be. Abner did the field test at the farm at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, because they had a nice population and it was isolated. So can you imagine checking traps with guys carrying shotguns? That was good. Okay, this was such a wonderful time, and we put away two bottles of tequila in my place, and this is how Lou and I really looked at the time. And I really, really enjoyed this time working with Dr. Du and Lou and going back and forth. We could do this whole thing for its own talk. Okay. In 1984, a really, really important event occurred for me. There was a meeting in Oxford that I was Oh, I gotta go on. Five? Okay. There was a meeting in Oxford where a whole bunch of international people got together. I was very lucky to go as a postdoc and be able to meet an awful lot of people here, and I'm not going to be able to go through all of this, but there were some really great debates. People really got into it this meeting. There was yelling and excitement, and then everybody would go and drink at night and drink more at John Kennedy's house, and we punted on the Thames and drank copious amounts of alcohol there and ended up at Shakespeare's theater watching Macbeth. And I came home with a plan because of a debate that had started there about the active space of pheromones. And again, this question of, do components have activities at particular stages in the male flight sequence? We went into the flight tunnel, took these three moths, again, tested them to a series of doses. You should look at the yellow asterisks at the bottom. Again, males are most sensitive at lower doses to the complete mixture. I interpreted this as an effect that would occur downwind. There were still skeptics, so we went out into the field, used the bubbles, measured the distance at which oriole fruit moths were active. This is Marlene Campbell imitating Wendy Meyer, doing the same thing, and we showed for a series of temperatures and a series of treatments that males were really active to this blend downwind. Very quickly, the question remains, how can that be? Now, I didn't do the neuro part of the neuroethology, but that's always the way I've thought. And this figure sort of encapsulates a lot of information that came about through the work of John Hildebrand's group, Neil Vickers here, who was a student of Tom's. And for these two moths, you can see that we have a lot of information about how these blends are processed, but in particular, this role of olfactory glomeruli in allowing the brain to detect the presence of all of the compounds, whatever their amount. So even though there's only 6% of this compound, it has an address pathway into the brain. And this kind of study has allowed Neil and I to do our internal imaginal disc transplant studies to study, again, more and more about pheromone blend processing. Okay, I gotta go really quick here. Okay, my last story is about rare males. We're gonna take this response breadth in a new dimension. And this is, again, the work you've seen this morning, Asian corn borer and European corn borer, and these two desaturations, and the fact that these females have both of these signals. And again, this is a coffee break story, and I'm watching Wei Qian Lu come down and talk about these different clones, and what are these things doing, and what are these genes for, and I'm sitting there, and Wendell comes up with this idea that this gave rise to this new female, and I'm saying, okay, yeah, so what? Who's gonna respond to her? You've got a European corn borer female putting out the Asian corn borer components, but there's no males around to respond to that. And he said, well, why don't you go in the flight tunnel and see if there are? So we went in with the European corn borer, and this is another one I was rolling my eyes, and damn it, he was right again. There are rare males in both of these species. Okay, and we went ahead with Tom Baker and showed how this is all being processed at the sensory level. I think this attraction area, this diagram still has a lot of future in it, especially with this talking about the evolution of signals. You have to thank the people that rear the insects in our group. This is fundamental to the success of Wendell's group. These are the people over the years that I've been there who are involved in rearing insects. Currently, Kathy Poole and Kelly Musto are those two individuals. And I like this picture. I call this Dad and the Boys. I owe Wendell everything. I owe these other guys a lot for setting the bar for the research that we do, and also having a hell of a good time. And I'll thank you for your kind attention.